but she should be on soon. And Johnny, in the meantime, you wanted to talk about what's happening in Albany with the Occupy Albany movement.
Right. There's an awful lot going on this weekend in the Hudson Valley, but it also happens to be the launch of the Albany occupation. People are arriving, starting to arrive at noon, and the first General Assembly will be at 5 o'clock on Friday the 21st in Lafayette Park in Albany. So, and after having visited the Occupy Wall Street encampment downtown in New York this weekend, I thought it was quite interesting because, you know, what gets a lot of press is sort of like the freak fringe element of it, and it was every walk of life was represented. I mean, every single one, every color, every socioeconomic group, every, you know, interest or, you know, various platforms were represented. And I also spent quite a bit of time talking with the police that were enforcing the perimeter, essentially, for all intents and purposes. And it was quite interesting. And actually, I was supposed to have a beer with one of them after he got off his shift and didn't take him up on that. But all of them were just extremely, I was surprised to hear this while they were on, you know, the city clock. They were very supportive of what was actually happening in Zuccotti Park.
Okay, this is in New York City. But
yes.
You were also involved. You there was an article in the local Register Star about your involvement in the Albany protest.
Yep, I'm going to help coordinate food, and this is a big part of it, being able to feed ourselves. And also, we're working with urban planners to get the layout of the actual encampment in the most functional possible.
And Johnny, when's that supposed to start? Today?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Okay.
Tomorrow at noon, Lafayette Park in Albany, downtown Albany.
Okay. Well, thank you, Johnny, for that. And thank you for going down there and being a witness and involved with that. Right now we have Kathy Nolan on the phone. So let's see if we can get her on. Hello, Kathy.
Yeah, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Yes. Kathleen, sorry about that mix-up with the times. But anyway, right now we have Dr. Kathleen Nolan, Regional Director for the High Peaks with us of the Catskill Mountain Keeper. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Okay. Well, we're still having some technical difficulties. Can't hear Kathleen very well. Kathleen, can you say hello again?
Yes, good morning. I can hear you quite well. I'm
okay,
sorry.
Okay, great. Thank you. No, we've got it now. Okay.
Great.
All right, so.
Glad to be with you.
See, it's felt like a battle to get you on the air this morning, but I'm glad that you're with us. Kathleen, I want to start off very quickly with what is Catskill Mountain Keeper and what does it do?
Mountain Keeper is a grassroots advocacy group that is interested in protecting the resources of the Catskill region and has been majorly involved in the opposition to unsafe drilling activities, the hydrofracking push.
Mm-hmm. Was Catskill Mountain Keeper an organization before hydrofracking, or was it created in response to the push for hydraulic fracturing?
We're a relatively young organization, mm-hmm. and we're formed just before people began to be aware in New York State that the drilling industry was looking to come in. The original issue that we were looking at was casino gambling, mm-hmm. Particularly in Sullivan County. Mm-hmm. And so the organization was had been formed, but had not started taking on any major issues. But the farmers in the region near Pennsylvania, where gas leasing was starting, came to Mountain Keeper and said, "We've got these people showing up on our door and wanting to lease our lands. What should we do?" Mm. And the staff at Mountain Keeper, Ramsey Adams, the founder, and Wes Gillingham, one of the co-founders, went with those farmers down into Pennsylvania to look at what was happening there, and were horrified that the thought that this was possible to come to New York State. So the little organization quickly geared up for something that looked like it was going to turn into a very, very big issue.
Kathy, there was a wonderful article, I mean, wonderful in the sense that, it was an expose, but very sad, about a farmer in Pennsylvania, a woman, maybe you could talk about it a little bit if you know the one I'm talking about. And she not only talked about hydrofracking's, the direct effects of hydrofracking, but all the ancillary issues that go with it, which are like the trucks, the smell of diesel, local housing prices going up and pricing locals out of their own homes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Exactly. Her story is not that unusual. It's more unusual for her to tell it this way publicly. But she was initially approached and thought that she could obtain one of these leases on her farmland. And it was presented to her in a way that made her feel that she would be able to continue living her life and just have some not too obtrusive gas wells over on some part of her land that perhaps she wasn't even using. And what ended up happening is that the drilling company has the right, once they have these leases in place, to put the drills and all their additional equipment wherever they want. There's noise and gas leaking fumes from those wells themselves, but also the trucks and the traffic that come to bring in water, take out fracking fluid that's been injected into the ground and then has come back up. And her dream of having some additional income on her property turned into a nightmare.
Right, exactly. And I highly encourage people to go to the website, Catskill Mountain Keeper, just Google it. There's a lot of great articles and issues, including some wonderful parts of the website that just talk about fun facts of the Catskill Mountains, which I thought were really fantastic. And I wanted you to, before we start talking directly about hydrofracking, I wanted you to describe a little bit for folks, especially who live in Columbia County. I mean, everybody's taken their trip to Windham or Hunter Mountain or taken a wonderful drive through the Catskills. But can you talk a little bit about the specialness of the Catskill Mountain ecosystem?
Yes. Our area is special in a lot of reasons. Scenic beauty, for one. We have in the High Peaks region many of the highest peaks in the Catskills. Some of those are home to rare and endangered species like the Becknell thrush. And we also have a great variety of bioregions so that, for example, birders can come to this area and see marshland birds, wood birds, forest birds. There's also some of the largest sections of unfragmented forest on the northeast that are in this region. Wonderful streams. The birth of fly fishing in America was in the Catskills. And for generations, there have been wonderful, wonderful fishing opportunities. And and currently, a lot of the industry that supports the region is actually the tourism industry, if you want to call it an industry, the tourism economy of people from around the world who come to this region to enjoy its scenic beauty. The romantic painters came out into the streams and the hillsides and the mountains that we can walk and brought their paints or their brought their imaginations to paint those scenes. And we can do the same, and we can go out and see a bend in the stream that has been captured in one of those paintings. So it's an amazing area, very rich in especially natural history. And set aside the Catskill Park region, set aside for the enjoyment of the citizens.
In fact, that was one of the first national parks created, am I right? Or
exactly.
Well, because we're limited in time, I wanted to get right to the issue of hydrofracking. This is going to be tough, but I do think in a minute or so you could talk about what exactly hydrofracking is, and first of all, and this is not a new issue to folks who've been listening to Tell It Like It Is or WGXC. We've been talking about it now for at least over a year. But also, I wanted to ask why Catskill Mountain Keeper asked for a total ban on hydrofracking.
The technology is really pretty simple to describe. It's basically injecting large amounts of water underground into areas of shale and stone that have natural gas clinging to it. And the water is under pressure, and it has chemicals in it to, the pressure explodes the rock and creates fractures, and then the chemicals that are in the solution are used to hold those openings open and allow the flow of the natural gas back up to the surface where it can be collected. The amounts of water used are very large, and the chemicals that are used are, in many cases, known toxins. And the fracturing under pressure is basically small underground explosions. So all of those elements create hazards. The materials that are put in are not materials that most reasonable people would want put in underground, where there's potential for them to leach into the aquifer. The industry claims that doesn't happen, but emerging science suggests that it does indeed happen, and it can happen perhaps not over hundreds of years, but maybe over many smaller numbers of years, like a few years or 10 years.
Dr. Nolan, I'm sorry. As you're talking about this, and this is Johnny Ortiz. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yes.
We just, obviously, in the Catskills, that side of the river got hit very hard with Irene and Lee. And having that much wild water in places where it isn't normally found, and especially in those quantities, how would that have impacted or interacted with the hydrofracking and the chemicals that you're talking about?
Well, it would have had the potential to wash them all into the streams. As did happen in some places in Pennsylvania where they have open fracking pits. So this is the kind of risk that the state is proposing to take under regulations that don't require closed pits. And it's just that's just one example. There are hazards at each step of this, including just the simple hazard of the trucks coming in and the increased traffic on the roads, which can result in not only air pollution, but also more hazardous conditions for people trying to use those roads for other purposes.
It's very interesting.
Emergency vehicles.
Very interesting. Dennis Kucinich has come out formally against geothermal, specifically because he believes that we're just making too many holes in the earth for various reasons, and that's causing a lot of tectonic instability.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to that. When you look at the network of rivers and streams that we have on the surface of the earth, there's no reason to expect that there's fewer networks underground. In fact, there's every reason to suspect there may be more networks underground. And when you pierce into that, and then especially when you explode, underground, you can create fractures that you don't have any control over, and you don't know then what chemicals are going to go where, and what new connections that may be harmful to people's aquifers may be formed.
That's a very important point. And before you go on and tell us exactly why you guys are totally against for a total ban on hydrofracking, one of the things that I found also on your website, which I think is very interesting, is from Columbia County, we're obviously an agricultural county, but it says that 400,000 acres of land is currently under cultivation in the Catskills. And I don't think a lot of people know that. One of the farms that you mentioned, Lucky Dog Farms, got hit very hard by Hurricane Irene. So can you comment on that very quickly? Or?
Well, yes, this is a region that has been used for agriculture and, as I said, for recreational tourism. It's a residential area. And if the industry comes in, basically that's a shift in the use from these necessary and enjoyable uses towards the industry's proposed use. And that's could leave these farms that would be nearby in an untenable position, especially if they're organic farms, being near some of these industrial activities could cost them that designation. And even if it didn't, it can also just harm the food.
Well, and
or discourage them from using the land for the farming, encourage them to go elsewhere where they feel that they could have control over the way the crops are grown and what the crops are exposed to during every cycle.
And generally undermine the confidence.
Right.
I know that the Park Slope Food Co-op, one of the largest in the country, has said that they will not purchase food for the co-op that comes from any area that is fracking.
Exactly. Mm. These farmers have invested their livelihood in creating healthier food, and the movement of many of these counties and of New York State has, on other levels, been towards improving the health of our citizens, and this activity cuts directly in the opposite direction.
So Dr. Sullivan, Dr. Nolan, very quickly, Sullivan County, a lot of the counties that you're talking about, Ulster County, Sullivan County, these are very poor counties. Up here in Greene County and Schoharie County, people are in very difficult situations, even before the economic fallout in the last couple of years. So the argument is, how would you answer the cry for jobs, a way of making some money off of land that for a lot of folks is not bringing any income. It's difficult on the one hand to be a farmer in these areas. How would you answer their needs?
It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. Many of these farmers are struggling, and so the offers from the industry are very tempting.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple of avenues to address that. One is the one that Mountain Keeper is working on is to help make farming as a livelihood more easily sustainable, make resources available to farmers so that it's easier for them to make a living from farming and do what they prefer to do. This is the chosen lifestyle of folks, and so to make it possible for them to see economic benefit in farming rather than have to turn to the drilling activities. And the other is that it's part of the role of the state to prevent an unfair encroachment on people's lands. So if the drilling industry is coming in and saying, we'll give you this amount of money, but they are leaving the land in an unusable condition, as is most often the case, then they actually haven't fairly portrayed the cost of the activity.
Mm-hmm.
Nor have they portrayed the cost of the activity fairly to the rest of us, because the exemptions from the Clean Water Act and Safe Water Act, Clean Air Act and Safe Water Act, and the Superfund laws mean that any harms the industry does, they don't have to pay for. So they've basically shifted those costs to others, and then have the money available to offer to a farmer at huge levels. So making the negotiations about all this fairer, making the harms visible, and then asking the state not to let certain harms take place at all is the first step.
That's a really good point, Dr. Nolan. I want to ask you very quickly, because we really have, we're going over time, just a couple minutes left. Why Catskill Mountain Keeper is asking for a total ban, where a lot of folks are saying, well, maybe we can do hydraulic fracturing with a lot of supervision, and if the state really properly supervises this can happen, and, you know, it'll be a win-win situation. Why is Catskill Mountain Keeper, number one, asking for a total ban? And then if you can just let the audience know where we're at in the process right now with oversight with
public comment.
And public comment. Thanks.
The ban issue, Catskill Mountain Keeper initially did not call for a ban. We were looking to see if there was a way to do this safely. And we over time increasingly came to the conclusion that we couldn't find a way that it could be done safely, and certainly not under the fast-tracking, the really quick, quickly moving permitting process that we're seeing. So it seemed to us that the only safe course was to call for a ban in New York State and keep gathering more information from other places that are allowing this activity. And the growing information is not good. So our decision to move to a ban, call for a ban, has been confirmed by problems with earthquakes, problems with flooding that have, problems with air pollution that have been
And what exactly is the industry's response to something as dramatic as having, you know, I think we had 3 500-year flood incidents in 3 years? I mean, this is obviously now a part of our reality in this region. So how do they propose that they are going to be in compliance or protect the environment and people who have not actually signed off on these leases?
Yes, I don't think the industry has really acknowledged those dangers. You know, it's easy enough to say, oh, well, that was a 500-year flood. We won't see it again for 500 years.
And then get another one 6 months later.
Right. So the data is increasingly there to say that the industry should be forced to look at this, but that requires the will of the people and the will of the state under pressure from the people. And that leads to the next steps, which is basically the permitting process is in motion. The New York State, through the Department of Environmental Conservation, has proposed regulations and has issued a draft generic environmental impact statement that would be the balancing, would be the document that shows the balancing of the harms and the benefits of proceeding with issuing generic permits, which makes it very easy for the industry to open up new wells across the shale areas that they want to drill. And the DEC has scheduled hearings. There are 4 hearings scheduled across the lower part of the state in November. Mm-hmm. We are encouraging people to continue writing the governor mm-hmm. and saying no to this across the board. Mm-hmm. We also are participating in this regulatory process because if it does go through, we want it to be as stringent and as protective for people as can be in allowing an industry that we don't feel is safe in the first place.
Well, Dr. Nolan, I thank you so much. We're definitely going to have you back on. I'd like to also at some point talk to you about what it means to be a pediatrician and also your particular standpoint as a pediatrician, or viewpoint, I should say, on the effects of hydraulic fracturing on people's health. But in the meantime, we have to run, and I want to thank you again. I encourage people also to go to CatskillMountainKeeper.org, one word, CatskillMountainKeeper.org, and thank you again for joining us. Yes, thank you very much, Dr. Nolan.
Oh, thank you very much for having me with you and for giving attention to this issue.
Okay, our pleasure. Okay, bye-bye now.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll be joined right now on the phone with, no?
We're going to go to a musical break. And when we come back, we'll have Dr. Margaret Flowers. She's been very active in the single-payer healthcare push and is currently one of the primary organizational people behind October 2011, which is an occupation movement that's taking place in Washington, D.C.
In the meantime, Johnny, can you read the pledge from the website?
Sure. And I'd like to direct people to the website, and that is October2011.org. And this is a pledge that they're asking people to make that are is sympathetic to the efforts. I pledge that if any U.S. troops, contractors, or mercenaries remain in Afghanistan on Thursday, October 6, 2011, as that occupation goes into its 11th year, I will commit to being in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. with others on that day or the days immediately following for as long as I can, with the intention of making it our Tahrir Square, Cairo, our Madison, Wisconsin, where we will nonviolently resist the corporate machine by occupying Freedom Plaza to demand that America's resources be invested in human needs and environmental protection instead of war and exploitation. We can do this together. We will be the beginning.
Thank you, Johnny.
My baseman is a ghost, and my ghost is a news carrier. News carrier, back me up, man. I had some pain, I became your satellite. Got to get it all right. Sight, I know a man called Sylvester. He must wear a bulletproof vest, y'all. No kind of way, no kind of way at all. Music live, children learn. I made it trigger happy, but I wish that I had a puppy to show me right from wrong and good from evil. This is the future, eh? I ain't gonna shoot you, eh? And if you feel you got the move, I man can supply a groove. I man can sue for real. Had a daddy, had a papa who ran away from my mother. See? Those who have eyes like mine, let them shine. All time, all star. I had some pain, I became your sonic satellite. Got to get it all right, just right. I know a man called Sylvester. You have to wear a bulletproof vest, y'all. No kind of way, no kind of way through the day. Music live, dirty learn. I made it trigger happy, but I wish that I had a puppy to show me right from wrong and good from evil. This is the future, eh? I ain't gonna shoot you, eh? And if you feel you got to scream, cause you're dealing with the cream, you're not wrong. Had a daddy, had a papa, who ran away from my mother.
Okay, and we're back, and that was a little Finley Quay, and we should have Dr. Margaret Flowers on the phone with us.
Can you hear us, Dr. Flowers?
Hi, how are you? Yes, good morning. Great. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I just want to read a quick bio on you so people know who you are if they don't already. Dr. Margaret Flowers is a pediatrician, a mother of three children from Baltimore, Maryland. Left her practice in 2007 to advocate full-time for single-payer health care, served as a Congressional Fellow for Physicians for National Health Care Reform, and is on the board of Health Care Now. She is co-director of It's Our Economy, which you can look up at ourEconomy.us. She has organized for healthcare, peace and economic justice, which have included arrests for nonviolent resistance. Dr. Flowers, thank you for joining us this morning. My co-host Johnny Ortiz from Pharmacist Productions read the pledge that is online, which is a fabulous pledge on October 2011. And sorry about that.
I'm sorry. We're in the middle of, unfortunately, there's a protest going on in D.C. right now. And so they're communicating with me.
Great.
Trying to keep me up to date with what's going on.
Oh, great. Can you tell us, are you at the protest site right now?
No, I'm off-site doing the press work. So there are people right now inside. They shut down a Citibank close to the White House because Citibank has reported record profits again, but they're continuing to foreclose on people's houses. They're not paying taxes. You know, it's just, you know, more of what we see from the big banks. So there are people shut down inside the Citibank right now as we speak.
Well, Dr. Flowers, can you paint a picture before we get into that of exactly what the October 2011 Move Coalition is, where you are, and what you are trying to achieve?
Sure. The October 2011 movement is an independent, nonviolent movement that I've been involved in organizing from the very beginning. We started back in April because we saw the kind of the reality, which is that when each of us advocate on our single issues, which for me was primarily healthcare, we don't have the strength to overcome this corporate stranglehold on our political process, mm-hmm. but that in fact all of these issues are connected, all of the issues for peace, social, economic, and environmental justice are connected, and our strength would be in coming together and really using nonviolent tools to start to shift the power away from this corporate stronghold and towards meeting human needs. So we've been based in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., starting on October 6th. We have an encampment going on there, and each day there are actions that go out from that occupation, as well as during the day on the plaza. We have general assemblies, which everybody is invited to. We have educational seminars and workshops, and then each night we discuss a different issue. So we have 15 core issues identified on the website, things like housing, healthcare, jobs, education, the environment, these types of issues, and we're having these discussions each night to start developing this platform of what are the specific changes that we as people want to see going forward from here. So right now there are the target today was a Citibank, because they just announced their record profits, mm-hmm. and right now there are six people locked inside the Citibank in Washington, D.C., close to the White House. They shut the bank down protesting.
Fantastic. I mean, I think this is really important that people are starting to discover their own sense of power. And is that what is behind these movements? Is as much as just that people can discover and empower
absolutely.
Themselves?
Absolutely. It's people, you know, in this country, we've seen now several decades of declining. Declining kind of indicators of our social well-being. So we're seeing increasing wealth inequality. We're seeing wage stagnation, or even wages now going down. We see increasing numbers of people who are unemployed, who are dropping into poverty, who are unable to get health care that they need, unable to afford education. And it's kind of been building up silently. You know, people have felt kind of alone and isolated and like maybe it's their fault. And finally, people are coming out in the open and saying, no, it's not our individual fault that this is happening. It's a result of kind of the way the political process is in this country that funnels the wealth to the top, mm-hmm. and that, you know, we're told these lies that, you know, we don't have the money to meet our human needs, and that's just not true. We saw all of this going on with the deficit, this fake deficit crisis that we had this year, where they're saying, oh, we just don't have the money. We can spend whatever we want on wars, but we just can't spend money on important things like Medicare and, you know, and education and those types of things. And so people are finally coming out in the open and saying, no, this is not right, and we're not going to be silent about it anymore. So it's really exciting to see that this has really sprung up all around the country and all around the world.
What would you be happy to see as an encouraging development / response from either the administration, the Fed, some of these big banks? I saw an interview with William Black yesterday, and I'm forgetting which bank it is, but they have huge amounts of toxic assets that it's now legal for them to transfer them into the portfolio of Bank of America, that we have given a taxpayer guarantee to keep afloat. So when Bank of America is then further destabilized by absorbing these toxic assets and it wobbles, it's going to be taxpayer money again that's going to be bailing them out.
Right. I mean, I think that these banks that are so-called too big to fail need to actually fail and be restructured and, you know, made into public banks so that they can be transparent and accountable to the public. We're not looking to the administration for anything right now. We spent a lot of time as we were organizing this movement kind of studying nonviolent transformation and how power is actually shifted. And there's, you know, this is really just the beginning of what's going to take a long time to turn things around. What we want people to do is stop looking to leaders mm-hmm. for the solutions and start coming together in their communities and looking for things that can be done there. Start moving into meeting our human needs. You know, if someone's being evicted from their house, the community should rally around them and prevent them from being kicked out of their house. If someone is not able to get health care, we should be rallying around that person and demanding that they get treatment. We should be not putting more money into these corporate, you know, banks and corporations that actually act against our best interests, and start putting our resources locally into doing local currencies and creating cooperatives and things that actually work outside of that corporate economy, but that we can use to meet our human needs locally. And that's kind of where our strength will come in building up those types of things. And then eventually, as we start to weaken the powers that have a hold here in this country, and we can start to shift the power, then we'll start seeing some real changes.
But you're talking about a real ground, grassroots direct democracy. You're talking about...
Right.
Right, and you're talking about something that actually steps outside of the current government and the current system, or economic system.
Absolutely. If we play within the rules of, you know, the current legislative and electoral process, we lose. I mean, that's been tried over and over now for years, and you can't win in this electoral system if you're not part of the Republicans or the Democratic Party, and even if you are part of that party and you actually represent the people's views instead of the corporate views, you're quickly disappeared. You know, they find some reason to get rid of you. If you try to come in as an independent, the whole game is rigged against you. You just can't succeed at that.
You're marginalized, yeah.
Right, and the Republicans and Democrats actually collude to exclude independent candidates. That's, you know, one time when they really do come together. So, in terms of the legislative process, it's that's been tried as well, and it just does not work in the interest of the people. It's not based on policy or what's best for the majority of people. It's based on what the special interests want, and I think that people are starting to wake up and see that more and more, and that's really important that we not waste our time on elections at this point, but see this as the beginning of a long-term movement, and that it really is coming together in our communities. The first step is talking about what's going on, and then the second step is, okay, what can we as people come together and do? Because we do have the resources and the strength if we unite and start working within our communities to change things.
Speaking of electoral process, which I couldn't agree with you more, it's been an abject failure. There's no accountability whatsoever after someone's been elected. Obama basically turned that into a caricature of that example. One of the concerns that people have is that if you don't get out and vote for Obama in 2012, the slate of GOP candidates is like so frightening that even if a slight possibility exists that one of them could actually wind up in the White House, that that alone is reason enough to continue to participate in electoral politics.
Well, that's been used for, you know, centuries now. It's the lesser evil, like, oh my gosh, if you don't vote for this person, the other person's going to be so awful. I mean, if we look at what President Obama has actually done, and it's just a fact that the political process is not within anyone's control. You know,
yeah.
It doesn't matter who you put into the White House
exactly.
Right now. They're not in control of what goes on. Wall Street's in control of that. So, President Obama was elected, and everybody, you know, because they did such a fantastic job of marketing him, nobody wanted to protest him when he was putting forth
right.
policies that were Republican policies or taking us into more wars. And so some people actually call him the more effective evil because he's able to get away with things. But look at what happened when Scott Walker in Madison, a Republican, you know, started pushing through this awful budget. People got out and they came together and they protested it. And that's what it's going to take to shift the power. We've got to get out there and really be not symbolic in our actions, but actually, you know, shutting things down, demanding change, and then coming together and figuring out how we can meet our needs within our community.
Well, Greece is having a general strike as we speak. I was down at the occupation in Wall Street and have been involved with the occupation that's taking place in Albany, soon to be taking place. And what I don't quite understand is why is there not a call for a general strike?
Yeah, labor's been really disappointing because, you know, we've been reaching out to labor from the beginning to get on board with this. I mean, their agenda is really the same agenda as the 99%, but there's a real split in labor between the rank and file and the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And at the leadership level, labor likes having this in with the Democratic Party, despite the fact that they don't get anything that they want. It's like an abusive relationship. They continue to stay in it because they like having access to the White House, even, you know, though it's not giving them anything. So Labor's going to have to get over that if they want to be effective, and they're dying off because they're not representing the rank and file, and the rank and file sees that the leadership is selling them out. So it would really be smart if Labor, you know, got on board in a real way. Unfortunately, we've had Labor reaching out to us in D.C., and what they're reaching out to us and saying is, well, we want to reelect President Obama, and we're saying, well, that's not our agenda. So, you know, it'd be great if they could get their act together.
Well, just as an aside, we will be having Steve Early on next week, and Steve Early is a known labor activist and journalist, and we'll be talking about that very issue, because labor and, in fact, the working class in this country have not really understood what their issues are, and have been co-opted since the 70s, I think. And what I wanted to ask was about these people's assemblies, because in my mind, you know, on the one hand, I see that government is important because government is, in fact, being knocked by a lot of the right wing and saying we have too much government. But government is what can enact nationally policies such as Medicaid and Medicare. But on the other hand, our government has been co-opted by Wall Street. In fact, Obama has just was in the news, has had record fundraising from Wall Street.
15.5
So the question, my question to you is with the people's assemblies, is on the one hand, yes, I could see doing things in my neighborhood, in my community, but on the other hand, there are certain things that have to happen on a national scale. How do you organize so that those things can happen, those things can be changed? For instance, an ending of the war in Afghanistan, or the enactment of universal health care.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you're right, it's governments run by Wall Street, and that's the problem, and there just isn't the possibility of achieving these legislative goals. We're not going to get the war to end or get universal health care by using a strictly legislative approach. It's just broken. It won't happen. So we have to really, like, step back and say, okay, how do we do this? There are pillars that uphold this current system, and those are the pillars that we have to start weakening, and it's things like bringing the police over onto our side, and that's been starting to happen in a lot of these occupations, particularly in D.C. We have an excellent working relationship with the rank-and-file police. They understand, and we talk with them quite openly about what's going on and how, you know, changing things is going to affect all of us and make it better for all of us. We've got to get the civil servants, you know, government employees to start seeing that, you know, it's okay to start speaking out and talking about, you know, exposing what's going on and the things that are wrong with the government, because we've got to kind of expose the corruption, and that starts to weaken it. And then we've got to just kind of start disrupting business as usual. That's what we're doing in D.C. with, you know, shutting things down each day. And then in our local communities, we just really need to be more militant in what we're doing. If there are, you know, movements where people are blocking evictions, there's movements where people are taking over abandoned buildings and saying, you know, we need this space for our human needs, and so we're going to take it. And unfortunately, those are kind of the things that we need to do. We need to really place our human needs first and figure out how we jointly can start meeting those outside of the legislative process. And then eventually, as we start to shift the power, we will be able to make these changes. There will be concessions, but we're just really not there yet until we work outside of it and weaken it.
There was a movement several years ago, and I don't know if it's being revived or not, but it seems like good timing, declaring yourself a conscientious objector to paying taxes, because that is a very real issue. I mean, that's hard-won, hard-earned dollars, and families are getting stretched further and further and further on the cost of everything, and staying in your home, and heating your home, and feeding your kids, etc. So the less money that a family puts into the pot for the war budget, et cetera, or, you know, bailing out these banks, the pharmaceutical industry, et cetera, that's real money that stays in the household.
Right, and there are, you know, there is a War Tax Resisters League that has materials about how people can do this. I think if people in a community decide to do that, they're going to have to really support each other, you know, if there are consequences as a result of that. But there is a War Tax Resisters League that does, I think they have a website, and they also teach about how people can do this effectively.
So, Dr. Flowers, in the next couple of minutes that we have, and we only have a couple of minutes left, but we would definitely want you to come back on the show and update us on what's going on. What I want to ask you directly is, you're a medical doctor, and you felt compelled to move away from your job and to become a full-time activist. We had Chris Hedges on last week, and he talked about the gravity of the situation, not only in this country, but in the entire world right now, not only for people, but for the entire ecosystem. I think we're facing a real crisis right now in the world of resources. And what my question is to you is it, can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to become the activist you are today and what you're doing? And what can you tell people right now that they can do? What little bit can you tell them when they're overwhelmed? How can you empower them to say, okay, I think I'm going to call my neighbor now and I'm going to start this action?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me it was a real process, a journey. I did not come from a medical family. I went into medicine because I truly wanted to serve people and felt like doing pediatrics was important because you can have a profound effect on someone's life if they have a good start to life, and I wanted to be part of that. And what I found in practice was more and more that it was not about better health and not about what was best for the patients. It was a real game of trying to play whatever the insurance company's game was to try to get the care that your patients needed. And physicians have to compromise their integrity all the time. You have to fudge things on the chart or use code words or, you know, try to negotiate, you know, to get patients the care that they need. And that's not what I went into medicine to do. So as I started trying to, you know, figure out what was going on, and first working at the state level to see what was going on in health reform there, and then at the national level, it just became clearer and clearer that the traditional tools of democracy just aren't effective anymore. I mean, it's still important for people to try those things, but they're not sufficient. And that health, you know, as I went on kind of this journey, started seeing that actual health of a population is about much more than access to medical care. That's only about 10% of our health. The rest of it really has to do with what are called social determinants, which is education, and if you have a job with a living wage, and if you are treated with respect, if you have clean water and healthy food that's affordable. These kinds of things have a profound effect on our health, and so if we really want a healthy population, we've got to fight for all of these things. And I agree 100% with Chris and with others that we don't have a lot of time to turn this around. We have maybe a generation or two, so we can't really just sit back and hope that things are going to get better if we elect the right person or if we try to pass a particular bill. And so that's where my work with It's Our Economy comes in, is that
yes.
Through that website we educate people about alternative systems that they can push for or get involved in. There's a whole transition town movement that's vibrant around the world, and you can learn more about that on It's Our Economy. You know, that they're just coming together in communities, and they're mapping out what their resources are and what their needs are, and they're finding ways to work together. And you have groups that would not traditionally work together are coming together in a serious manner to talk about how they're going to meet their needs locally moving forward. So that's really important to do.
And I do encourage people to go to that website, It's Our Economy. Just Google that, and there are a lot of good ways to join in. And I love the fact that it says people before profits. And I have a button from the 1970s that has a picture of Angela Davis, and on the button, and Gus Hall, it says people before profits. So
yeah.
The first step
is really just get out and talk to your neighbors. Like, this whole occupation movement is just about coming outside of our houses and talking to each other. And so that's an easy thing that anybody can do, and then see where it goes from there. So that's something people shouldn't be too afraid of.
Well, I'm afraid we're really out of time, and I would love it if we could get you back on again to talk more about this issue, a very important issue, and we will be talking about it in the next couple of weeks. Johnny?
Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Flowers. Keep up the great work. You're an inspiration to us all.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now.
join us next week for
another edition of Tell It Like It Is. We will be joined by, again, labor activist and journalist Steve Early. And you'll be there next week, Johnny, I hope.
Yes,
and
I'm planning on it.
Very good. And coming up in just a moment will be Al Jazeera English. Thank you all for joining us.
Hudson. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre Hudson Catskill.
Shops and schools closed.
WGXC presents a special screening of the 1922 silent horror film classic Nosferatu, a Symphony of Horror, with live score by Brian DeWan, Jeremy Kelly, Jeremy Thal, Gideon Crevochet, Michelle Nicello, Saturday, October 22nd, doors opening at 6 p.m. at Basilica Hudson, 110 Front Street, Hudson, New York. All proceeds go to WGXC 90.7 FM, hands-on community radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
WGXC underwriting support provided by Sundog Solar at Solaqua Power and Art, Chatham, New York. Think outside the barrel with solar electric, new solar hot water rebates, and foam and cellulose insulation. SundogSolar.net.
This is Al Jazeera.
The government is cynical about union calls for more dialogue and alternative ways to promote growth. It's calling for unity, saying there's no other solution but to do what it takes for a second financial bailout.
We have to explain to the citizens, to those people that have given us the mandate to operate in their name, that unfortunately it's absolutely necessary to have to live through this phase in order to avoid a worse phase.
Greece is once again going through the pains of social unrest, and it's growing. Andrew Simmons, Al Jazeera, Athens.
Well, most.